case number 2, which is Entertainment Software versus Rod Blagojevich. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Casper, 13 minutes, 5 minutes rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, watch that light.
I will, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Casper on behalf of Governor Blagojevich. I am going to talk about the First Amendment issues presented in the case, and my colleague, Mr. Feinerman, is going to talk about the Attorney General's sovereign immunity issue. We believe that the sexually explicit video game law is narrowly tailored to meet the state's compelling interest in helping parents protect children from the exposure to sexually explicit material for two reasons. First, the material subject to the statute is only sexually explicit indecent material. And second, it is limited in its application to minors with no effect or infringement upon any adult rights whatsoever.
And it okay, is so we know that the harmful to minors statute protects children from accessing obscene material. And that statute uses all of the Ginsburg-Miller factors that we have to look at. So why is this Sevigel, or whatever you want to call it, necessary?
Well,
what material does it restrict that is not already covered by the harmful to minor statute?
Well, I think that what it covers is sexually explicit video games that are not necessarily obscene for purposes.
No. So why doesn't the harmful to minor statute cover that?
The harmful to minor statute, there are games that we put into the record, for example, that we believe are covered by the sexually explicit video game law that are not covered by the harmful to minor statute, meaning the difference between the two statutes is the absence of the third prong in the Ginsburg standard. And we think that the reason why that's an important factor is, and why that this statute is important notwithstanding the harmful to minor statute, I think is best summed up by what Justice Ginsburg said when she was on the D.C. Circuit talking about that very question. And the reason is there are some images or depictions that are so graphic regarding sexual exposure that regardless of the overall value of the work, that a parent ought to be able to make a decision that their child ought not see that depiction regardless of the overall value. So that value, as Justice Ginsburg analyzed it, is a factor in determining whether or not the work is patently offensive. But the existence of value in the work in and of itself does not excuse the work from being indecent.
Okay, so let's assume here that Dr. Ruth creates a safer sex video for teenagers and assume that it contains explicit portrayals of various sexual acts, and the players score points by engaging in safer behavior, and they lose points for engaging in risky behavior. Can a store be fined for selling this game to a 15 or 16-year-old? And
no.
No?
No, I don't believe so. And the reason for that is that this statute contains that first prong, that it appealed to the prurient interest. And I think the Supreme Court has talked about what does that mean.
At some age, everything appears to the prurient interest.
I seem to recall that, Your Honor.
You see, your memory doesn't have to go as far as mine.
So that example that you give, Your Honor, lacks one element that's necessary, I think, to be covered by the statute, and that is the sort of erotic appeal. The Supreme Court in Erzaznik, the nudity at the drive-in movie case, talked about in the footnote that in order for material to be covered, what's the difference between nudity, say, sex education nudity or National Geographic nudity, and erotic nudity? And I think that's a component that's required in this statute that I think would exclude the example that you gave from coverage in this case. Now, the district court, in rendering its decision, said that the absence of that third prong, meaning it regulating more speech than obscenity, rendered the state powerless to take any action. That the absence of that third prong alone was sufficient to render this statute unconstitutional.
Let me go back to Ginsburg-Miller, because I'm having a bit of a problem with your response. The harmful to minor statute uses all of the prongs of the Ginsburg-Miller test, including the requirement that the material lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. That means that the remaining parts of the SEVGL applies to material that does have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors, socially redeeming value.
But and
it seems to me that that's the fatal flaw of your statute.
Well, I think that that's the very point that we're trying to get at. If you look at Exhibit B to our Rule 56.1 statement, you'll see there are these graphic sexual depictions. And in the state's position, if you take those depictions and you insert them in the middle of King Lear, that's still enough for a parent to say, I don't want my child to see that.
But that's what we've got in the other statute. I mean, at no point have, in your briefs at any rate, have you been able to explain for me, I don't know, you know, about my brother and sister, but for me, how a statute that prevents children from buying material that's protected by the First Amendment can withstand strict scrutiny?
Well, to answer the question sort of in order, the statute at issue here, what we are saying is that these depictions that could be contained in these games, that King Lear doesn't necessarily lose its value because it has these graphic sexual depictions. But as Justice Ginsburg said in the Act One case, that those depictions alone may be sufficient, regardless of the value of the work, may be enough for a parent to say, I don't think my child ought to be able to see that. And in that statute, going beyond Ginsburg, the Supreme Court has had the occasion to consider statutes that went beyond Ginsburg, beyond obscenity, on several occasions. On two occasions, Pacifica and Denver area, they have upheld those statutes. And the plaintiffs are going to say, well, that had to do with the broadcast media, and broadcast is different. But what it is about broadcasting that makes it different is that the maker of the speech has no way to distinguish between children and adults at the time they speak. So the Supreme Court, in the broadcast exception, as it's called, has recognized that this interest is so important to keep children from exposure to this material that we're willing to permit infringement upon adult rights at the same time. So that's what the broadcast exception does. We don't have that problem in this case. There isn't a too many people problem. It's not adults and children, because this is limited in its scope only to minors, both on its face and in practice. And in other cases where the Supreme Court has considered statutes that went beyond Ginsburg, Playboy dealing with cable TV, and Sable dealing with telephone, and Ashcroft dealing with the Internet, in all of those cases, the statute went beyond Ginsburg.
You know, these are arguments that you maintained in the briefs the plaintiffs have conceded, and that simply is not true. Unless I'm sorely out of touch with what the plaintiffs were trying to say.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, in your brief, you stated that the plaintiffs have conceded that our statute here simply gives authorities to parents to decide what sexually explicit video games their children access, and that the statute does not stop a single adult from buying these games for themselves or for their children. And you then characterized those two points as concessions and as being determinative. But the plaintiffs can tell me, I suppose, but I didn't see any such concessions by the plaintiffs, you know, in their brief.
Well, the statute on its face is limited to application to minors. And the point that we were trying to make is that in all of these other cases where the Supreme Court has considered and even stricken statutes that went beyond Ginsburg, the Supreme Court never did so for that reason. The Supreme Court always went on to talk about additional alternative technologies that could allow adults continued access. They talk about blocking technology and subscription services and pre-subscription and filters, things that would allow adults to continue to have access while at the same time allowing the restriction to minors. And again, we don't have that problem in this case because this is limited to the application to minors. And the district court held that going beyond Ginsburg, going beyond obscenity, was in and of itself sufficient to invalidate the statute.
Well, tell me something. Are you arguing that the statute includes the third prong of Ginsburg-Miller?
No, we're not, Your Honor.
Right. So there it is. How can you argue that this is a narrowly tailored statute if it doesn't include the third prong of Ginsburg-Miller, so that it wouldn't apply to material with socially redeeming value?
And the reason for that is that the Supreme Court has never stricken a statute on the basis that it went simply beyond Ginsburg. It has always stricken those statutes on the basis that they applied to adults as well. And this statute simply has no application to adults.
I still don't see how you get around the problem with the third prong. That doesn't really answer the question, in my opinion.
Well, regarding the third prong, in both Pacifica...
Which you just said, you know, you're not trying to... Because I thought maybe you were trying to squeeze the language in or infer that, you know, somehow was covered by the third prong. But you're saying no, flat out no. I think, you know, that's a big problem for you.
We're not saying that. That's correct. That's already... covered as
right.
As
no, but I'm just following up on that. I don't see it. You know, the explanation you've given still doesn't address that, the failure to deal with that third prong.
Well, I think that the reason for that is that there are at least six cases dealing with the lack of the third prong, with the lack of all the prongs of Ginsburg, the necessary prongs to be obscenity, considered by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has never held that going beyond those prongs invalidates a statute. They have invalidated some of those statutes, but they always did because they also applied to adults. They could have saved a lot of trees in Playboy and Sable and in Ashcroft by simply saying, this statute goes beyond Ginsburg, therefore it's unconstitutional. They have never said that. Instead, what they say is, there's another way you can achieve this goal of protecting minors without having to...
And you think that this statute does that?
Absolutely, because it is, on its terms, it is limited to minors. Mm. It cannot, under any circumstance, apply to an adult. An adult has every right to play and possess any game that they want to. And in fact, children have the right to play and possess these games as long as their parents say that that is okay with them. And that's the type of statute that the Supreme Court has long given support to. Supreme Court.
What does label 18 tell us about the content of the video game?
The label 18 tells us that the clerk, when they're about to sell the game, has to apply the state's definition of what constitutes a sexually explicit game.
It might mean the game takes 18 minutes to play. It might tell me that Governor Blagojevich finds the game morally offensive. Other than subjective moral assessments of the content, what does this number tell me as a consumer? 18.
The 18, we believe, communicates commercial speech. It communicates to the retailer that this is a law that requires them to check identification. This is a game that requires them to check identification to make sure that the person is older.
That's a very interesting thought, of course, because it doesn't make any sense to me that a retailer is required to assess the product and decide if the 18 label is required. The retailer doesn't know all the scenarios that play out in the product. It's the manufacturer who does. Why not require the manufacturer to label the product? I mean, that Grand Theft Auto game is one that really goes against you because the objectionable scenes were not even accessible unless the buyer downloaded additional software from the internet, and the retailer would have no way to warn of that danger in advance of any sale.
Well, to answer the first question, is the retailers already have to play these games to comply with the harmful to minor statute. They have to be familiar with this game because they're introducing it into the stream of commerce anyway. And it's a felony to sell a game in violation of the harmful to minor statute. So they already have to know what's in these games. And regarding the 18 label, and why that's imposed upon the retailers. Well, they're the ones who are introducing it into this stream of consciousness, and they already have to have this the obligation of playing these games and becoming educated.
You are watching your lights, are you not?
Yes, as I am. Thank you.
Yeah, and although Judge Rovner was asking you about the 18, I mean, as you said, they already have to review. I'm still stuck on why that harmful to minor statute isn't adequate. And then, and I really haven't gotten a good explanation from you as to why that's not adequate.
Again, as I said before, the reason is that there could be games with some value that have images that are so striking that regardless of whether or not the game has value, a parent ought to be able to say, I don't want my children to see that image.
But I thought that's what the harmful to minor statute did. And then the other thing, you haven't answered that, then the other thing is, you know, this procedure where the parents can give permission in advance, where the parents can pre-authorize stores to sell certain things, you know, so the parents are involved. That's an alternative that could have been put in place.
Well, there is no evidence that such a system exists in the record, so we didn't really have the opportunity to rebut that alternative, and we'd be happy to do so. But what we're saying is that some games that do not reach the level of obscenity are so objectionable that a parent ought to be able to protect their children.
Okay.
And I'll keep the rest of my time.
Thanks, Mr. Casper, very much. Mr. Feinerman, good morning.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Gary Feinerman from the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, here on behalf of defendant appellant Lisa Madigan. As Mr. Casper indicated, I'll limit my remarks to the question of whether the Attorney General has sovereign immunity from suit or whether the ex parte Young exception applies. And at the outset, I'll acknowledge that it's not an easy question, and that's so.
You have a tough road to hoe, because I don't see how you can. I don't see. You know, you rely a lot on that Sherman case, but it's very different from our situation because there the Attorney General didn't have any power to enforce the statute. Here, you agree the Attorney General has the power to enforce the statute, right?
It has the contingent power to enforce the statute.
So the answer is yes.
Yes, the state's attorney doesn't enforce.
If certain factors come into play, then yes, the Attorney General has the authority.
And
so
that's
the answer, and
yes,
that's where I think
absolutely.
You're dead meat on that.
Yeah, if certain factors come into play, the Attorney General does have the authority to enforce a statute, and the Attorney General also represents the state in criminal cases before the Illinois Supreme Court.
Who would be the proper defendant in this case?
The state's attorneys.
All the state's attorneys?
Yes.
102 state's attorneys.
Yes, and I understand from my colleague.
Oh, Mr. Feinerman, that's so hard, isn't it?
There's a mechanism for doing a defending class. It's been done before. Let me give it a try in terms of why the Attorney General's contingent authority to bring a prosecution is not enough under Ex parte Young. And I mentioned at the outset that this is a hard case for two reasons. One of them is that Supreme Court precedent doesn't articulate a formula that leads to a clear answer. At times in Ex parte Young, the court says that an injunctive suit can be brought against a state official having some connection with the enforcement of the act, and plaintiffs, as one might expect, and as what I would have done were I in their shoes, fastened upon that some connection language, and they read it to mean any connection whatsoever.
What does it mean?
It doesn't mean any connection whatsoever.
Some doesn't mean any.
Some does not mean any, and we know that from the context of Ex parte Young, because in addition to using the articulation some connection, Young also says that the state official must be, quote, expressly directed to see to the enforcement of the statute, must have a, quote, special relation to the statute, and must be sufficiently connected with the duty to enforce the statute.
Well, let's look at it this way. According to the plaintiff's citation to the Attorney General's website, your office prosecutes over 500 criminal cases a year. That's a pretty high volume of cases.
Yeah.
And at what level of prosecution would you concede or that the Attorney General is a proper defendant in a suit like this? Would it have to be 1,000 cases a year? I mean, why isn't 500 cases a year enough to meet the Ex parte Young standard?
The answer has to do with the types of cases that the Attorney General prosecutes at the trial court level, and those cases fall into three principal categories. The first are statutes where state law actually gives the Attorney General either the exclusive or the primary authority to prosecute. The Antitrust Act, certain environmental crime statutes. And in those cases, you would have no argument from us that the Attorney General would be a proper defendant, because there, it's the Attorney General is the frontline prosecutor for the state of Illinois, unlike the case with ordinary criminal statutes, like this sexually explicit video game law, where the Attorney General really is not even a pinch hitter, but very secondary.